dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. And a woman who has been in more of the battle spaces of that war and engaged more constructively over a longer period of time, particularly in the role of a journalist, more so than just about anybody I can think of, is our first guest. She is Claudia Rosette. She is the journalist in residence at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. She is also a columnist for Forbes.com and PJMedia.com and a frequent guest with us, and we're always delighted to have her. Welcome back, Claudia.
Thank you for that very kind introduction, Frank. Good to be here.
All true and heartfelt on my end, and I'm just so pleased that you're here to talk about a couple of things. Given your background, both in Russia and China and covering, of course, the UN, so let's go through a couple of things that are relevant in each of these. At the moment, Claudia, as you know, it seems as though Vladimir Putin is moving inexorably to do to at least parts of eastern Ukraine what he recently accomplished in Crimea. Does this strike you as a surprise, especially in light of the response that he's had to his first annexation from the West, including, of course, the United States?
In light of the response he's had to his first annexation of Crimea, his first bite off Ukraine, it doesn't strike me as a surprise at all. The only question really has been the timing, whether he was going to do it now, going to do it later. But effectively, he's been invited because nothing really happened when he chewed off a piece of the neighboring country. The world said tut tut, and then just effectively accepted it wholesale.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this for a column that I did yesterday at Breitbart.com. You know, we provided meals ready to eat to a country that is ready to be eaten. And it seems as though it's only whetted the appetite for Vladimir Putin. You've talked about the sort of semi-isolation that the UN imposed on Russia. Give us a flavor, Claudia, of what happened there and more broadly by the EU as well as the United States.
Yeah, quasi, semi, sort of, not really. The UN Security Council, since Russia is impotent in this, because Russia has one of the permanent veto-wielding seats. So the UN Security Council has done nothing at all. That left it at the UN to the General Assembly, which doesn't pass binding resolutions. They're toothless, okay? They carry a certain a certain public influence or something, but they have no binding power. Not that the UN Security Council does either, but you know, it all comes down to who enforces things. But in this case, Security Council useless. It went to the General Assembly, which then passed a resolution condemning this annexation, 100 votes for, 11 against, and some abstaining, and another round, a few dozen just absent. Well, this was a resolution that actually only mentioned Russia once in its entire, in all the text, and that was in the context of a 1990s friendship treaty between Ukraine and Russia. So it ineffectually condemned the action of a nameless state, basically supposed to be in support of the territorial integrity of Ukraine. It was really just a completely meaningless document. And if 100 countries voted for it, that meant that 93, in other words, the almost half the UN General Assembly, did not. In other words, it was a gesture. It was a better gesture than if fewer countries had voted for it, but it was a meaningless, empty gesture.
Now, this prompted, presumably, among other kind of feckless steps that the so-called international community has taken, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, while out in another part of the world in which you spent a lot of your distinguished career, Claudia Rosette, to remonstrate with the Chinese that with great power status, which he accorded them, come great responsibilities. And he basically tried to tell them that they need to be nice to their neighbors. How does that seem to be playing, Claudia, especially against the backdrop of this, well, as I say, fecklessness with respect to Russia?
No, the Chinese aren't going to be terribly interested in what Chuck Hagel has to say unless it's backed up by something which is something very different from what's happening. What's happening is while Chuck Hagel is saying that, the Obama administration is gutting the U.S. military. That's what the Chinese will be paying attention to. And the other thing that they're paying attention to is what Russia has just done with Ukraine and is getting away with. Actually, there are a whole variety of things they're paying attention to. They're also paying attention to, since they're party to, the Iran nuclear talks in Vienna, which are playing out as a giveaway to Iran of effectively license in the end, what that's going to work out to carry right on until they have nuclear weapons. The Chinese are paying attention to the realities, Frank, not to the rhetoric.
Yeah, and presumably the prospect, as Chuck Hagel announced yesterday, that two more ballistic missile defense capable Navy vessels will be added to the American fleet by 2017 is not too much of an indication that things are going to get really bad for them. Claudia, Chuck Hagel is also doing one other thing apparently today. He's been talking up with the Chinese cyber warfare transparency. I just would like, based on your extensive experience with the Chinese in Hong Kong, notably, as a Wall Street Journal editorialist, what on earth is likely to come of sharing with the Chinese anything about our doctrine or our practices or our capabilities in this arena? Do you think that they'll show us theirs when we show us them ours?
No, it will save them the trouble of stealing it from us.
Via cyber warfare.
Yeah, China is where Edward Snowden first went. He went to Hong Kong, the special autonomous region before. I love Hong Kong, but it is part of China. It was given by the British to the Chinese in 1997. And that was where he spent the first strange, mysterious period before he went on to be welcomed in Russia. And the whole idea that if we are nice to them, they will be nice to us, that's just not a useful premise in foreign policy unless it's backed up by substantial potential force, and if you're dealing with troubling countries, and where they want to be nice to you because they don't want you to do something bad to
them. The consequences are ugly if they don't. Claudia, one of the things that I heard on National Public Radio this morning in connection with this transparency initiative by Chuck Hagel was a kind of moral equivalence, and I can hear this coming out of the people who were feeding their reporter, of course, that our hands are kind of dirty in this space too, because as Edward Snowden has revealed, we had all kinds of penetration into the Chinese People's Liberation Army associated telecommunications firm Huawei, and the Chinese have been doing some bad things in terms of penetrating our companies. Just a sanity check here, Claudia. Is there, in fact, equivalence between these two?
No. I mean, that assumes that you've got some colossal, overarching, impartial and fair rule of law in which if everybody follows the same rules, that's not true at all. And one of the basic problems in the way that foreign policy is being conducted right now, and with the assumption that if we're just nice to them, they'll be nice to us, and everybody should just follow exactly the same protocol, is that there is no grand authority that enforces good behavior by bad governments. The U.S. has played that role. That was the global cop role, right? The U.S. has played that role for a long time, and it's brought relative peace to the world for a long time. That is now breaking up. That's terribly dangerous. And you can't look at the U.S. and North Korea, the U.S. and China, the U.S. and Iran, or in the U.S. and Russia as Putin is now leading it, and say, we're all just operating under what? The auspices of this thing called the international community. What is the international community? It's a
It's the group in which we're going to turn over, apparently, the management of the internet. And Claudia, that's a subject for another day, as is the Senate vote yesterday to object to the installation as the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations, a man who was involved with holding our diplomats hostage for 444 days. Claudia, so much more to talk about. We'll look forward to doing it with you again very soon. In the meantime, keep up your superb work at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and your wonderful columns at Forbes and PJ Media. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Diana West on a new Cold War. Whatever happened to that last one, anyway? Right after this.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
On August 2nd, 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
Debbie Lee became a Gold Star mom that day.
And it started a lifelong mission of her own. In Mark's honor, Debbie founded America's Mighty Warriors.
Dedicated to supporting the troops and their families.
AMW educates the public through speaking engagements, rallies, and events to raise awareness and appreciation of our military.
AMW advocates for the troops.
Funding, rules of engagement, benefits. AMW is committed to being a voice for justice for our troops. AMW serves Gold Star families. Retreats, concerts, special events.
Good things to remind the families they're not forgotten.
America's Mighty Warriors.
Nonprofit.
Dedicated to the troops and their families.
Donations are tax deductible.
Log on to americasmightywarriors.org.
Find out how you can help.
The best of America deserves our best. Log on today.
americasmightywarriors.org.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Diana West, nationally syndicated columnist and best-selling author, notably, most recently, of American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana's a regular here with us, and we're always delighted to have her with us. Welcome back, Diana.
Thank you, Frank.
Let's talk a little bit about an insight from American Betrayal about the Cold War, and specifically how it wound up, whether we won it, why we didn't say we did, and what lessons there might be for what you've described as possibly a new Cold War emerging.
Well, these are the questions, actually, that sent me off on my excursion through the past. I was always perplexed, as I'm sure you were and many of our listeners tonight, with the fact that the Cold War came to an end. We watched the Berlin Wall come down. We saw this massive disengagement on the Soviet side as the Warsaw Pact forces were dissipated and sent home. And yet there was never a moment of triumph, never a national thanksgiving, a reckoning, a sort of coming together of the Cold Warriors in order to make the case that freedom had triumphed over tyranny. And this was something that was very clear with President George Bush 41 and his basic ethos about the whole thing, which was first to try to shore up the last Soviet dictator, Gorbachev.
Yeah, keep it going.
Keep it going. And then, of course, we come to the sort of mustn't gloat doctrine, which was certainly in the early 90s. So what did that leave us with? And why? So these were sort of the questions. How could this be? And then when you compare that to the end of World War II, where we have such a victorious, rightly so, celebration over Nazism and fascism, and indeed a reckoning about the systems, what did that leave us with? And this is where I sort of use as a launch point to try to understand this. And I did come to an understanding, and that is essentially what much of the book is about.
We're visiting with Diana West, the author of American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character, also Death of the Grown-Up, and a syndicated columnist about the Cold War. And you're musing about it in your new book, Diana, American Betrayal, and how it might relate to where we are today and maybe tomorrow. Talk a little bit about your insights.
Well, and this is a distillation, I would say, probably about 2.5 years of reading and thinking, but in a very small nutshell. There was no, what we have failed to take into account is the tremendous penetration and infiltration of Marxist ideas, of communist ideology, of Soviet techniques into our own system. I'm not speaking just about the disinformation campaigns that I think people are pretty up on having come out of Moscow, but essentially the activities inside our own gates by Americans, by American traders, by American fellow travelers, and so on, that in a sense take us to a place where today our college campuses can rightly be described as outposts of Marx. Well, that does give pause to the notion of winning an ideological war over communism, when indeed we've incorporated so much, and we can look at all the latest headlines about Obamacare, socialized medicine, nationalized healthcare, this tendency to go to state control over so much of our personal affairs, whether it be economic, health, personal, political, and so on, coming from central, increasingly centralized government. Again, a mirror, a fuzzy mirror of what we would look back on in terms of the communist system, socialist system, to be sure. So this is why I think we come to a place where at the end of hostilities, at the end of a military standoff, you might say, in the Cold War, there was no capacity for a clear philosophical or principled victory or discussion thereof, because we had been so changed. And I guess that is where the title American Betrayal comes from. So moving forward, kind of in this morass, I feel that we've never really dealt with either our own actions in this sort of collusionary, if that's a word, collusive collaboration, maybe with through appeasement, through policies, through engagement, peaceful coexistence, détente, all of these things that kept us locked together with the Soviets over time, we've never really sort of unraveled from that. And so I think in many ways this is why we have such confusion and difficulties in dealing with various assaults, namely Islamic assaults, a new ideological threat, because we've not dealt with the previous one.
Yeah. to say nothing of the one that is reemerging, it seems, from the Kremlin at the moment. Diana, there's so much else to talk about. Let me switch gears quickly. I want to visit with you. You have been thinking seriously over a long period of time about the condition of our military, the wars we've thrown them into, and the conditions under which we force them to fight. One of the heroes, in my judgment, of the effort to have our military remain robust and capable of fighting the nation's wars properly, I'm very sorry to say, passed away last week. He was General Carl Mundy, the 30th Commandant of the United States Marine Corps. And among his many accomplishments, both in uniform and after taking it off, it was his leadership of roughly 1,100 former general and flag officers who opposed President Obama's efforts to engage in one of the many kinds of social experimentation with which he has assaulted the military, namely allowing openly homosexual individuals to serve in it. What thoughts do you have on where that's left us in terms of, you know, this kind of hollowing out of our military cum social experimentation?
Well, you're right to use the word assault, because, again, this does become a vector of assault on bedrock traditional principles. And certainly we've seen the military as being in the what we might very aptly use the word vanguard of this kind of social experimentation, whether we see it in terms of feminization of the military, where we, you know, go back 20 years and the big discussion had to do with putting women into increasingly militaristic roles. Now we have that with the stroke of a pen, I believe it was just last year, made law. And with the homosexual service, you know, you have another vector of this same kind of assault, again, on, I don't think it's just the military. I think it's part of the change in society to remove all remaining strictures of the Judeo-Christian world. And it becomes much more of a macro battleground, really, a cultural battleground, as well as just simply wreaking havoc on, you know, certainly the way the military functions and serves. So this becomes, it was a very important fight to make, and it is astonishing that the military was not able to control it. But again, it is a wider canvas, and you're looking at the impact of these same sorts of socializing, communizing, Marxifying efforts on the broader population coming to bear on this. I mean, it really is, you know, we go back to the Communist Manifesto had to do with a rupture with all tradition, with a rupture with all traditional morality, and this is one manifestation of that.
And as Jerry Boykin points out, this secularization of the military and the society writ large is a critical stepping stone to that Marxist ideal of basically saying the state provides you with your rights, not them being inalienably descended from, you know, your maker, divinity, your creator. And this is really part and parcel of the transformation of not just the military that the Obama administration has been about, but of course the transformation of the United States of America, as he declared 5 days before his first election. Diana, so much more to cover, but we'll have to do it again next week. Thank you very much for joining us today. And as always, your thoughtful analyses of these cultural as well as national security challenges is deeply appreciated. Keep up the terrific work at your column and here. And we'll talk with you again next week. Next up, Andy McCarthy on will we go to war with Syria after all, right after this.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk. Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Ginny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Effney.
Welcome back. It is one of the high points of my week that we get now to introduce to you once again Andy McCarthy, a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very pleased to say. He is also a regular at National Review Online and PJ Media, where he writes extraordinary columns each week, and also, of course, at Fox News and in other outlets. He is currently helping us think our way through a problem that he's wrestled with for a long time, and that is the reports, Andy, that the Wall Street Journal has on its front page. The John Kerry State Department and Samantha Power at the United Nations are now hot to get us into the war in Syria, not just training the so-called rebels, but actually in the fight, over the strong objections, evidently, of General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This has the feeling of deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra said. What do you make of it, and is this likely this time around to get us embroiled in that conflict?
Well, I guess the bottom line, Frank, is that Libya went so well that they just want to do it
again. One more time.
Yeah, in Syria. I think his position at the moment is a little bit difficult to unwind, which I guess I've gotten in the habit of saying about John Kerry for about 30 years now. But, I think he understands at least the conclusion of the journal piece today. I thought almost canceled out the whole, pages of the beginning of it, which basically is that, Kerry understands, he says, that there is a danger of getting us entangled, and there's a real difficulty in finding a sufficient mass of quote-unquote moderate Islamists to align with, that he's not insisting that we go forward this minute with his idea of getting us further entangled, but that's, that's something that's more aspirational on his part. So, I think that essentially under Kerry, we have a catastrophe in Syria. We have a catastrophe in the Israeli-Palestinian talks, which are about to go off the rails. Some of us, of course, said, that was a guarantee when Kerry started them. We have a growing crisis in eastern Ukraine that Kerry seems to be baffled by. He thinks that he has these conversations with the Russian foreign minister, Lavrov. He seems to think he and Lavrov, settle things, and then turns out that Putin has an entirely different plan. So I just think that, anyone who's watched Kerry's career all these years knows that, he, like Biden, like a lot of people of that school, have been wrong on just about everything for 40 years, and the fact that he continues to be wrong about everything is not terribly surprising.
A very well said and certainly deserved denunciation of Kerry, and what an abomination that this is the best we could do for Secretary of State. I am struck in the article in the journal today, Andy, that one of the considerations that apparently is weighing on John Kerry in tempering his insistence that we go to war on behalf of, I guess, anybody but Assad, is that it will screw up the fruits of his diplomacy, such as it was with the Russian foreign minister Lavrov over eliminating chemical weapons from Syria. That hasn't been going perfectly as it stands, but he understands that it'll get even worse if he goes to war with Assad.
Right. Well, it's been going the way that we said it was going to go at the beginning, which was that that whole thing was just a farce to give Obama a face-saving way to get off this idea that he the red line business that he wasn't going to defend anyway. But this was a quote-unquote honorable way for him to step out of it. He didn't need to defend the red line because the Russians, our friends, Vladimir Putin, were going to they were going to clean out the chemical weapons that they had put there in the first place.
Well, it seems they've cleaned out some of them by sending them to Hezbollah in Lebanon, and that's not considered to be an improved condition for these things by any stretch of the imagination.
Any port in a self-created storm.
That's correct. You mentioned the peace process, Andy. I guess actually the best thing that can happen to it, it seems to me, is that it goes off the rails, given the character of, and the manner in which it's been conducted.
No, and look at what they want. This could only have come from Kerry and Obama, right? We free Pollard, the spy, so that the Israelis free a bunch of terrorists. And we call that and then the Palestinians come to the table. and make more demands while not recognizing Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state and continuing to demand the right of return. I mean, what could be better? What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, this is really a perfect paradigm, isn't it, of the blood?
Yeah, I don't mean to chuckle. It's just, you know, when you sit around tearing what little hair you have out, watching us do the same things again and again and again, I think you can either chuckle or cry, and I don't think your listeners need to hear me weeping here.
No, so. I understand. We appreciate the gallows humor, I guess, is what it comes down to. Andy, speaking of gallows, one of the things that you've been addressing lately in your columns is a film about the systemic mistreatment, misogyny, I guess is the $4 word for it, of women under Sharia that is portrayed, I think, rather beautifully in a film called Honor Diaries by our friends at the Clarion Project. Megyn Kelly has given it some attention at Fox News, your friend there, and also CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, has given her some attention for having given it attention. Talk a little bit about the film. I don't know if you've actually seen it yet or not, but about what you know of it, and more to the point, how it has become a political football here from folks like the Islamists of CARE.
Frank, I have not seen the movie. I've seen clips of the movie. I've not sat down and watched it from beginning to end. But I think this came to me as an issue of censorship, really, and a continuation of the effort by CARE and its enablers on the left to try to impose Sharia blasphemy standards on the United States, which is to say that any treatment of a public issue that holds Islam or Islamic cultures in an unfavorable light is something that people should not be allowed to see and to consider in terms of drawing their conclusions,
no matter how accurate that light might be.
Yes, and you know, look, I think that there are people who I usually down the line agree with who are associated with the film. I'm thinking Ayaan Hirsi Ali in particular, who's the executive producer of the film. There are other people who I think highly of involved in the film. I got a chance to meet with Quanta Ahmed last week. I was very impressed by her. On the other hand, you know, a lot of the people who are involved in the film are believing Muslims, some of the Muslim reformers, who are trying to develop an alternative interpretation of Sharia, whether they think it's you know, the classical one that the Muslim Brotherhood follows is you know, inaccurate, or they think it's been superseded by events, or they think they can confine it to allegory. To me, that's an interesting dynamic, and I'll be very interested to see how it comes out. But my bottom line is, if CARE doesn't want you to see it, you should see it, and you can quibble over whether the reason that you have the misogyny culture in these Islamic countries is directly because of Sharia, that was an argument I made in a column over the weekend, or whether there are cultural factors at work that and the Sharia has been misinterpreted, that's all very interesting. But the fact is that these are Islamic cultures, and this is a problem that happens in all of them.
Andy, I have had a chance to view the film, and I must say, I think it's a very powerful indictment. While Quanta, among others, I think made some comments that may not actually stand up to scrutiny, like Sharia doesn't have anything to do with female genital mutilation or castration, really, more accurately described. I happen to think that's probably dead wrong, but the overall thrust of the film is to portray, as it must be seen, this Sharia program as powerfully and horrifically repressive of women, and just one of the reasons why we don't want it in this country. Andy McCarthy, we'd love having you in this country and having you on this program. Thank you for joining us today, and we look forward to doing so again with you next week. We will turn next to Ted Brahmett of the Heritage Foundation on the Arms Trade Treaty, what it might mean for you. Straight ahead.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them.
When you make fun of them.
When you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com. Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved, and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined once again by Dr. Ted Brummond. He is currently the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom's Senior Research Fellow in Anglo-American Relations at the Heritage Foundation. He is a columnist for Newsday and also writes for Great Britain's Yorkshire Post. He contributes regularly at Fox News and in other outlets, and we're always delighted to have him back here at Secure Freedom Radio. Ted, welcome. It's good to have you again.
Great to be back with you, Frank.
Well, you are one of the country's preeminent authorities on a piece of UN mischief-making that has not gotten nearly enough attention, I'm very pleased to say. Thanks, I'm sure, in no small measure to your good efforts. It's beginning to get a bit more attention on Capitol Hill. Remind us what the arms trade treaty is about, and then what's been going on up there with respect to congressional concerns.
Well, the arms trade treaty is a United Nations treaty that purports to set out standards for the international arms trade, mostly standards having to do with human rights. The U.S. already has policies, of course, governing the export of conventional weapons. So this treaty certainly won't do anything for us. The difficulty that I see in it fundamentally is that the human rights standards are extremely vague and liable to be used by other countries and activists inside the United States to criticize American policies, especially support for Israel and Taiwan, but also other things that they find inconvenient.
And to the extent that this becomes an impediment to, for example, our arrangements to provide for security assistance to countries like Israel, knowing the UN as we do, it seems to me it's setting us up for the kind of efforts that the UN incessantly makes to isolate Israel, to reduce its security, and otherwise undermine our interests in that very important ally in the world.
Yeah, nothing really good can come out of this. And I think everyone would agree that it would be nice if Russia, China, lots of other countries around the world, Iran, were far more responsible in the way they dealt with conventional weapons. But you're not going to get that with a UN treaty. You're going to get that if and when those countries get better governments. Then they might behave better. But the idea that you can force this kind of change on the international system with a treaty is just a classic fallacy. If this sort of thing worked, UN arms embargoes would work. But they don't work, and the supporters of the treaty admit this openly, and then go on to argue that because UN arms embargoes haven't worked, a treaty is going to work. This is just absolutely ridiculous.
Tell us about the kind of concerns that are now being expressed on both sides of Capitol Hill about it, Ted Broman.
Well, there have been a number of letters from the Senate and from the House, and I want to pay my respects to Senator Jerry Moran of Kansas, who's led the opposition in the Senate, and Representative Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania, who's led the opposition in the House. Both of them have been real stalwarts in this cause. There have been a number of letters recently. Senator Moran sent a letter a couple of days ago expressing his renewed concern. He led a group of 50 senators who expressed concerns back in October, concerns that the White House has not even responded to, even formally, much less in a serious kind of way. And Senator Moran was calling attention to these concerns. Representative Kelly led a similar letter back in October with 181 representatives on it. He, too, has received no response, so he again was reiterating his, like Senator Moran's, determination to keep up the fight. And in a development that really got no attention at all, I'm disappointed to say, Representative Kelly submitted letters signed by at least 80 of his colleagues, four letters and a slightly different number of people signed, demanding the inclusion of language preventing the spending of money, appropriations, in other words, in various appropriations bills that are now going forward for defense, homeland security, justice, one other department. And if included, that language, that text, would essentially make it impossible for the federal government to expend any money on the implementation of the arms trade treaty, which would be a very positive step.
Well, this is very important, and I'm delighted you called attention to it here, Ted Broman, because it does seem to me that the administration's conduct in not answering these letters and in evidently seeking in no way to move this treaty to the Senate for its advice and consent, indeed with 50 senators indicating they were opposed, it would be a dead letter. But Ted Broman, remind us of how this works. Are we obliged to conform to this treaty, even in the absence of Senate advice and consent and its ratification?
Well, we should start off by pointing that the U.S. in the person of John Kerry has signed the treaty. So just to sort of put that out there on the table. The sort of grade school understanding that we all have of the treaty process is that the president signs, the Senate provides its advice and consent, and only then does the treaty become part of U.S. law. Well, that's not really the way it works, unfortunately. We have developed this doctrine, and this is not something the Obama administration, this is a number of administrations, that once the president or the secretary of state signs a treaty, that the U.S. holds itself bound to uphold what's known as the treaty's object and purpose. So we're in the neighborhood of obeying the treaty, although it's not quite the same thing as obeying the full treaty, without the Senate having given its advice and consent, in fact, without the Senate even ever having looked at the treaty. And I and a number of other people think this is a very dangerous doctrine that is essentially unconstitutional, and that we should revise the way we handle treaties to make it sure that we're not put in the position of essentially complying with a treaty that the Senate has never provided its advice and consent on or even seen.
It's even worse than that in a sense with the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. The Senate actually rejected it by a majority vote, and we're still observing it, as best I can tell, still spending money to help its implementation. This is indeed long overdue. I'm delighted you're calling attention to it, Ted Brahman of the Heritage Foundation. It is one of those aspects of our Constitution that I think desperately needs some shoring up. Ted, let me switch gears, if I may. You've written recently a piece that I thought was very important with your colleague Steve Bucci at Heritage about a decision the Obama administration has taken that is profoundly troubling, I think, even against the backdrop of the massive hollowing out of the military that's underway. The cancellation of the Tomahawk cruise missile production line stands out as a singularly ill-advised initiative. What's up with that, and what might be done about it at this point?
Well, the administration has announced, or rather the U.S. Navy, which is the responsible arm of the service, has announced that starting in 2016, there will be no more Tomahawk cruise missiles purchased, and that the existing missiles will be recertified, in other words, examined for whether they still work or not, in 2019, federal year. Now, it's true that we do already have a stockpile of roughly 4,000 Tomahawks, and that would seem like a fair number. On the other hand, the administration's argument is that we've looked at all possible scenarios, there is no way we'll need more Tomahawks, so we're good. Well, the history of American military involvements is that we never know what's coming down the road. We always get it wrong. We always find out we need more of something than we think we're going to. And for an administration that has really hung its hat on the idea that future wars are going to be fought via standoff, in other words, not a lot of American ground commitment, it's a very strange thing to say that they can foresee the future so clearly to know that we're not going to need any more Tomahawks. I find that a very difficult argument to accept. It's even more difficult because our allies, the British, and in the future, the Australians, have built a substantial part of their navy around the Tomahawk program, a program which we have just canceled.
As has the United States Navy, for that matter, and the president is apparently, as we've been talking about with Andy McCarthy, thinking about going to war with Syria. After all, there will almost certainly be a lot of Tomahawks expended in that process, as was true of Libya. And these calculations are always wrong. I remember back in 1978, I believe it was, Ted, I was cutting my teeth working for a Democratic senator by the name of Scoop Jackson at the time, and the Carter administration came in and said, we have exactly the number of Mark 48 torpedoes that we need, the only heavy underwater naval torpedo that the United States had at the time. And they were determined to end the production of that as well, again, without replacement. And fortunately, that decision was reversed, and we're still producing them, I believe. We need to produce the Tomahawks. We appreciate very much your clarion call on this and that of Steve Bucci. Keep up the terrific work you do at Heritage, and come back to us with further reports on all of these fronts, if you will. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.